Hello and welcome to Adapt Radio. My name is Dr. Claire O'Connell, and today we're talking about how AI can enrich our understanding of history.
From the Adapt Centre at Trinity College, this is Adapt Radio, presenting groundbreaking innovations one conversation at a time.
Now, how we view the past is very much shaped by the stories we're told about it. But many stories from history are about men. Where were the women in all this? A new project called Voices is using artificial intelligence to uncover women's experiences of extreme trauma and civil war in early modern Ireland. The project was recently launched at Trinity College Dublin, and joining us to talk about it are two Trinity researchers. Professor Jane Ullmeyer is Erasmus Smith's Professor of Modern History, and Professor Declan O'Sullivan is a Professor in Computer Science in the School of Computer Science and Statistics. Jane and Declan, you're both very welcome to the programme.
Great to be here, Claire.
Great.
So the project Voices, it blends high tech and history, and it's a great name for a project. Why did you call the project Voices, Jane?
Because we literally wanted to see if we could hear the voices of these women who've been hiding in plain sight. Now, of course, Claire, there are no recordings from the 17th century. So it's more looking at those records and imagining their voices rather than actually hearing them. And I really wanted to focus on non-elite women as well. They're sort of what ordinary women, in inverted commas, who are even less visible than elite women. So, I'm glad you like the title.
And why that period in early modern Ireland in particular, that period around the 17th century, what was happening then that made you want to look at it?
Well, there's two reasons. One, a very practical one. I just finished a book called Making Empire, where I'd realised that women have a hugely important role to play, both as promoters and as colonisers, but also then as resistance, leading resistance to colonisation and imperialism. And so it was a very personal project at that level. But then, of course, this period is a very much a transitional one between the medieval world and the modern world. And to fully understand the modern world, you really have to go back to the 16th and 17th century, because it's during this period the foundations are laid. So it's just a transformative era.
Declan, can you tell me a little bit about the approach you're going to take to looking at the data from way back then in the 16th and 17th centuries?
Yeah, the data is vast. Right. But it's unlocked. It's kind of locked up at the moment in terms of physical manuscripts. And so the first task that we really need to do is to unlock that, get the text into something that we can work with, into data. And so we're using a tool called Transcribus, which is a machine learning AI kind of approach to analyzing handwriting and turning that handwriting into actual text and tokens that we can actually deal with. And so that's the first task, is really getting access to the actual data in its own right. And then everything builds from that. We have a pipeline that we start to look at to see, okay, well, what's the particularly interesting pieces of data that we want to pull out, that we want to call out, that we want to find, and then connecting those data items together into what we call a knowledge graph, which is a way of representing the data in a network of data, a bit like social network analysis, if you're familiar with that, where you essentially have data items like a person and they have a name and they have an occupation, they have a place where they were born, and you can then connect to other people who were born in that place and so on, right? So that knowledge graph then becomes a substrate for us to work with the data coming from many, many different sources over many different periods in many different shapes and sizes, and extracting particular pieces of data that we can then apply meaning to and interpret, and then go and analyze and pull out stories and so on.
So this is a lot to unpack there, Declan. You talk about sources of data, you know, and Jane, you were talking about the need to find the stories of the non-elite women in there. So where are those sources at the moment? Are any of them already online? Have they been digitized? Or where are you going to be finding those texts and handwritten documents?
It's a combination of both, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, I mean, to begin with, we're only going, 6 months at this stage, but we've started with some data that had already been structured in that sense, that had been transcribed and some analysis had been done on it, had been presented in sort of CSV files, if you like. And the great rich source, and Jane was the key PI in this many years ago, the 1641 depositions, they were called, and maybe Jane can explain a bit more about the actual, what that tells us in the history of it. But from a computer science point of view, it meant that we already had a starting point, if you like, people that were identified, some characteristics about those people. And so we could start to already build a knowledge graph. So we already have a proof of concept, if you like, undertaken, where we've uplifted from those set of spreadsheets, if you like, that were developed many years ago, and put that into our knowledge graph. But, you know, now we're moving on to sources that haven't been digitized as yet, haven't been transcribed, haven't gone through the process that was essentially quite a heavy manual process at the time for the 1641 depositions. Jane would be able to comment about how many person hours were used in actually getting that into a shape that even could be analyzed via a spreadsheet. And so the hope here is that as part of the pipeline, as part of the approaches and the technology that we're looking to bring to bear here, that we're trying to scale up essentially the number of sources, the number of diversity of sources that we can essentially deal with and analyze. Does that, Jane, you know more about the 1641?
No, well, just the 1641. So 1641, that was a project that dates back, oh my goodness, to 2010. And it took three women working full-time for 3 years to fully transcribe and mark up 8,000 depositions, which are all here in Trinity. And these depositions basically are witness statements regarding a major rebellion that broke out in Ireland in 1641. And of the 8,000 deponents, nearly 1,000 of them are female, and then thousands of women are mentioned. And what's so important about them is they're non-elite women, these women that we're really chasing in voices. So can you imagine how long that took us? And using Transcribus and artificial intelligence, that project could probably be replicated in a matter of months, even weeks, Claire. It makes me feel sick just saying that and thinking that way. And so when it comes to these new bodies of records, so the digital data that we do have, let's focus on that for a moment. We've got the 1641 depositions. We have fabulous records of debt and credit called Records of the Statute Staple. We also then have other digital resources that form part of the amazing Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland, which is our colleagues have been reconstituting the archive that was blown up in 1922. And I'm particularly interested in the landed records in the virtual treasury, something called the Books of Survey and Distribution, which basically tell you who held land in 1641, 1670, and then again in 1704. Now, all of that is already all available in digital format, along with some very important maps known as the Down Survey maps from the 1650s. So, of course, we want to build on that. But we are now starting to go back into the archives, as Declan has alluded to. And there are really two archives that we're focusing in at the moment. One is the amazing National Archives here in Dublin, and the Irish Court of Chancery, which is one of the most important courts. It's the Court of Equity and Conscience in the 17th century. And thousands of those records actually escaped the fire in 1922 and have been painstakingly restored. So one of our researchers is about to go into the archives and he will photograph those. And then from the photograph, it goes through Transcribus, this program that Declan is talking about, and it gives us a digital transcript. So it's going to take him a few months to do this, but a few months versus a few years. So that's one big project. And then the other one is looking at wills. And another one of our researchers is really focusing on wills. Now, sadly, not many wills have survived. The original wills have survived for Ireland, but in the Irish archives, but many have survived in London. And Brona is repeating this process for wills. And then, as I say, we're just warming up here. We will then go through other major manuscript collections, or printed works that we will then, it's much easier with a printed work to convert it into some sort of digital format. But I mean, it's been a period of scoping, but also, as Declan said, we wanted to build that knowledge graph to fail fast, to pick up on one of his expressions, because there's no point in developing a knowledge graph if it doesn't work. and we were very keen to test that technology quickly. But I think we're both very happy with the initial findings.
Brilliant. Are there any challenges with going back to documents that are from centuries ago, when maybe even the way words were spelled or phrases had different meanings, etc.? How do you overcome that challenge when you're using machine learning? When you're a human, you know, you can look at something and you can make sense of it slowly, but you can make sense of it. But how does machine learning do that?
You're right. It's dirty data. I mean, there's no consistency around spelling, around grammar, around punctuation. There's very frequent use of contractions, in other words, abbreviations. But for example, the parish of Kinalmeaky, there are 27 variant spellings of it. So then you've got, you've got lots of issues there, but then you've got euphemisms. So for example, the word rape is very rarely used in the depositions, yet we know women were raped. So they will either say, you know, they were deflowered, they were ravished, they were badly used, they were taken by the hair. So there are all of these euphemisms then that we have to, and I'm coming to Declan, and now over to you, Declan, how we actually, you know, turn that into a spreadsheet that the knowledge graph can help us interrogate this stuff.
Yeah, and I think a key to that is, accompanying a knowledge graph, we have essentially a schema, right, which is like a conceptual way of considering the way of classifying words, if you like, right? So violent events, or, you know, being able to describe property loss and so on in a very generic kind of classification kind of sense. And that provides us a schema, essentially, to sort of say, A, it helps drive figuring out what are the kind of things we're looking for in the data, but also then once we start to find words and terms, we can then classify them against the scheme, the conceptual schema. So in that sense, with those different words, for example, we can essentially treat them as a bag of words, if you like, that we can then associate with a concept, right? Because a lot of the, I suppose, interrogation of the data will be not so much down on individual terms because of the problem that you mentioned, you know, so many different ways of expressing the same issue. But you're going to find the historians looking from a conceptual point of view to say, okay, well, tell me the violent events that happened in this area in this period of time. And they're not going to initially be so concerned about, oh, tell me all the events with this term. So that's an added benefit to the knowledge graph approach, because we can essentially have a conceptual graph of the key concepts that we're interested in, and then being able to associate labels or terms or words with those concepts as such. And that drives the natural language processing techniques that we will apply. So although we are using some AI, we're also using traditional NLP approaches. And, you know, these have been developed over decades now in terms of, you know, how do you associate a word with a particular concept and so on. So there's a nice mixture of bringing the technology together in this pipeline.
Brilliant. I love that expression, a bag of words. I think it conjures up a nice image. And of course, you know, it is all about the stories and the images that come out of these data sources. What kind of stories have you already been starting to uncover through the work, either preparing for this project or getting going?
Well, I'll maybe speak to some of the stories at my end, because Declan has been, I mean, obviously...
I'm a tech.
Yeah, we're trying to... what we're trying to do is put these archives in conversation with each other, and that level of interoperability that the knowledge graph affords allows us to really focus in, for example, on names. And you're going to identify the same woman in different sources. Now, this would have been needle in a haystack stuff if you'd been trying to do it manually. And I'll give you a single example. There's a woman called Hester Lambert. Now, she actually probably isn't as ordinary as I would like. And I'll talk a more ordinary person in a moment, because Hester Lambert's husband also appears in the Dictionary of Irish Biography. But so we know her from the Dictionary of Irish Biography, but we don't really know anything else about her. And when we did the draft knowledge or the knowledge graft, we discovered that Hester Lambert was popping up as a moneylender on the statute staple, but she was also popping up in some of the chancery records. She was involved in a lot of litigation, but she also was popping up in another source, which were the chancery records in London. So we were seeing her in the Irish chancery records, the London chancery records, the statute staple. And then, you know, all of a sudden you're able to reconstruct her story in a way that the DIB article, which is all we have about her, doesn't even begin to touch on and understand her complexity. She's a formidable woman, Hester Lambert. We can see that very clearly. But basically, her husband has left her looking after a young family. And she sort of has come out of the shadows to take care of her kids, basically. And she has two children, Jane Lambert and Charles. Charles then leaves a deposition, one of the 1641 depositions. So again, this intergenerational connection we're able to make. And then her daughter, Jane, we're seeing her appear again in the Court of Chancery and in the statute staple records. And that's just a single example. But the one that probably I think has intrigued us most is this woman called Catherine Strong. Now, I was seeing Catherine Strong, her name appearing as a moneylender. Again, women are hugely important as moneylenders. And remember, this is an age where you have no banks, no credit cards. So you're actually having, if you want cash, you have to go to somebody to borrow the cash, and then they'll record that debt on the statute staple. So anyway, who is this Catherine Strong? Well, you do a little bit of digging, and it turns out she has an official title. She's the scavenger for the city of Dublin. And I was like, scavenger for the city of Dublin? What does that mean? Basically means she's responsible for collecting all the animal and human dung from the city of Dublin. Now, let's imagine the city of Dublin, Claire, at this point. It's Ooh. Really...
I can five smell six, it already.
Right. Five or six streets in and around Christchurch Cathedral and Dublin Castle. 8,000 people crammed in there, producing a lot of waste and garbage and rubbish. And it's now Catherine, it's her job to get rid of it all. Well, she's supposed to have six teams of garbage collectors out there. She only has two teams, but she's charging everybody as she goes along. So she's clearly price gouging effectively. And then she's dumping all of the rubbish into the Liffey. And then the river is getting blocked as well. And then the smell, the constant complaints about the noxious odours. So we know about her from all of the complaints about her, but she's clearly, as I say, making a few bob, which she then is able to invest as a moneylender. She's also buying property. So we're seeing here a really formidable, you know, female businesswoman, entrepreneur. She's a widow when we first meet her, but by the time we take her career, this is in the 1630s, she's remarried. And even though she remarries a Dublin merchant, she doesn't, if you want, then defer to him. She maintains her independence and autonomy, which is also very unusual, because you must remember, a woman has no legal status except through a man unless she is a widow. So a woman in the 17th century is effectively a chattel of a male relative, whether it be her husband or her father. So seeing her exercise this level of agency is just fantastic. And again, for me, the hook there was the statute staple, and then using that to connect with other records.
That's amazing. So is it your sort of premise here that there are potentially thousands and thousands of such stories that are just buried in the data and we haven't made the connections with them yet? And this is what you want to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say there's tens of thousands. Now, we probably aren't going to make sense of all of those, but we certainly will be able, and we'll pick case studies, because we, you know, we'd love to do all of Ireland, of course, but there's just too much data. And so what we'll end up doing, obviously, we want Gaelic women and Catholic women to be as prominently featured as Protestant women. even though the archive is very much, the focus is on the Protestant and the English women in Ireland. So that is a huge challenge for us. And where we find evidence of those Gaelic Irish women and living, especially in the west of Ireland, we'll want to put a spotlight on that, or in Ulster. But we're also interested in, you know, different types of occupation. And that might be women working as labourers and their relationship with the land and with farming, as market gardeners. We're very interested in their engagement with trade. So, for example, they might be working with their husbands as tanners. We see them, I mean, all over every aspect of the early modern economy. And so, as I say, we'll take examples, case studies that hopefully capture the richness and diversity. And all of this then will be published online. And it opens up this archive then for other researchers then to do their own case studies and their own research based on the knowledge graph and the material that we're collecting.
I was going to ask you about that. So these digital archives that you are creating as part of the project, that you're generating, these will be available to other researchers, other historians, other people who have an interest in this kind of way of looking at history. That's amazing. And Declan, from your perspective, how can you support other historians who want to take this approach? Will your instructions on how to make a knowledge graph, for want of a better term, be out there too? Is that something that you'll be sharing with the international community?
Yeah, I think it's really important. And in fact, some of the approaches that we've been taking here underpin essentially the knowledge graph we helped to create for the Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland that Jane referenced there a minute ago. And that came out of the Beyond 2020 project, Beyond 2022 project. And in that sense, the approach that we took in terms of how we worked with the historians in developing that knowledge graph was something that we essentially are applying now with Jane as well. But we're now only really in the position to start to go, right, now we're comfortable enough with the process and the methodology that we're using that we start to share that out there in terms of a process and approach, a way of doing it, because in that sense, we've some good experience now having worked with two different teams and looked at, the pros and cons of the approaches that we've taken to date. We're hoping to share that. And I think in general, anyway, that's the approach Jane is very keen to follow, is especially when we're starting to move and use potentially more novel techniques here, for example, generative AI, and exploring that. And these tools are essentially more directly programmable or usable or configurable by the historians themselves, right? But there's huge challenges in how you actually, in that sense, how you, the methodologies yourself build up to see what's successful and what's not, and so on. And it's very key, I think, that as a community of historians, that kind of knowledge sharing is built up, because otherwise you just have silos of people trying, maybe not having great success initially because they didn't have knowledge that somebody else had tried something. So I think there's huge benefit coming down the line here, I think, not just from the technical artifacts that we develop, but also just the approaches that are being taken and then sharing that out into the community. And very much Jane takes a very open approach to sharing the methodology as well.
Completely, Declan. And it's the methodology, it's the ontologies themselves that we'll develop, we'll share. And I think this is where using Ireland as a case study, I mean, hopefully it'll be very transferable into other geographies and other time periods if we can develop this, which is obviously something that we will do. I also just want to go back and say about the collaboration with Declan from the very outset. Everything we do is open source. everything we do is transparent, because I think that's really important to both of us. I know, and we have many conversations about this. Okay, we're not in a position to publish 6 months in, but by the end of this project, we really want everything to be freely available on a completely open source basis. But it is worth emphasizing, I think what we're doing here is very novel for the humanities and particularly for history. And as far as we can figure out, it's the first time knowledge graphs have really been applied in the historical domain the way that we're doing it. So I think there's going to be huge interest, if you want, from the historical / humanities community in this.
Absolutely. And the project is funded by the European Research Council, which, congratulations on that. They are not easy ones to win. So well done. But, you know, the whole thing about the ERC is that it is about that sort of, you know, taking a step more or less into the unknown, inspired by curiosity and seeing what new things we can find there. And that's very much what you're doing. Just to go back for a moment on that collaboration across disciplines, that interdisciplinarity, that's something that is becoming more and more coded into how we do research now, and that's as it should be. But I'm curious to know, As you've been working together, have there ever been moments where you found yourselves, oh, we're talking across purposes, or what have you learned from each other in that interdisciplinary environment?
I'll start, Declan, and the reason I want to start is because actually Declan's been involved in this project even as I was writing the grant. And I think that's the most important thing or lesson I have learned. I've been collaborating with computer scientists since 2004, really, in the context of the 1641 depositions. But it was the first sort of deep collaboration with Declan. But I knew that this project was, if you want, high risk, high gain, and it would only succeed if it had a really novel technical, logical component to it. So, I mean, I have found it an absolute pleasure to work with him. And there's such a high level of respect and trust. And I know that if Declan says it's worth a doing and he understands it, I may not, Claire, but the fact he does, as I say, then I'm absolutely happy to do it and go for it. So for me, that's one of the most important lessons has been that. But I also would say computer science love to reduce everything to spreadsheets. So we're all now fully spreadsheetable in a way that we were before. It takes time, though, to really appreciate and understand. And I think that's at both ends. But there's a wonderful knowledge engineer who's working on the knowledge graph, a former student of Declan's. And then we've two historians. And we will continue to add to that team and bring in a literary specialist and also somebody who does some number crunching. And then a natural language processor, I think, is coming in at the technical end. But it takes time to build a team. And I think you have to be willing to invest the team. But I know this project would not be what it is without that collaboration, which is, to my mind, extremely deep. And we meet weekly. And I'm deeply grateful to Declan, who from the very beginning bought into it and has given his time, his knowledge, his expertise with such generosity.
You're right, Callum Chair. But from our point of view, the collaboration is the key word here, right? There are some digital humanities projects where you'll see this CS or the computer science or the IT guys essentially are a service in some sense to the project. But this truly has to be, it only really works from our point of view where we're getting something out of it as well. And in particular, from this knowledge graph perspective, which is the research domain that I'm working as a computer scientist, it's very much looking to see how can we enable more direct access and involvement of historians with the technology itself, right? Rather than it being mediated through a knowledge engineer, because a lot of the tools related to the knowledge graph technologies at the moment are very much designed for knowledge engineers, computer scientists in some sense to operate with. And so both with this and the VRTI, the Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland projects, the collaboration, I'm getting out of it is that ability to understand, hopefully try and understand a bit better what's important, what would work in terms of technology and how do people interact with it and the engagement with it and so on. So that we can, in that sense, tailor the tools and develop tools that eventually, you know, maybe by the end of this ERC, it's actually we'll be moving away from spreadsheets, which is currently a very pragmatic way that we can engage with the historians, to a scenario where they're already altering the knowledge graph themselves, changing the schema themselves, being able to add in new data sources, zero touch from a computer scientist, knowledge engineer point of view. So the real benefit here with these interdisciplinary projects is where there's a win-win from both disciplines, if you like. And that's why I really like to engage with these kind of projects. And they're great people to work with. So I find it fascinating, just the subject material and what I'm discovering as well as a byproduct is just amazing.
Just to say that the reciprocity that Declan's just touched on, of course, is key. But we're also very lucky in Trinity because we've got two big institutes that we're both based in. So I'm based in the Trinity Long Room Hub, Declan's in ADAPT, and there's this reservoir of knowledge and expertise that we're able to tap into, as well as hugely supportive colleagues at either end who are really, they want to set you up to succeed. So it means that you're not dealing with the bullshit. I mean, somebody is there really doing everything possible to allow us to focus on the research. And I appreciate that hugely. And I think it's one of the great advantages of working here in Trinity are these amazing institutes or SFI centres in Declan's case that we're very privileged to be part of.
Jane, is generative AI part of the mix in the technology here?
Generative AI is simply one tool in a bag of tools that we're using. And it's still, the jury's still out about how useful generative AI is going to be to us. We are experimenting with ChatGPT-4. And I think, again, Declan has been very good about giving context, explaining some of the ethical issues or guiding us around the complexities. And I think that it's such a fast moving space. I can't imagine, Declan, that by the end of this project, we will not have engaged with generative AI.
Sure, we can always come back next year and...
talk about generative AI, because I'm sure we will be at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jane and Declan, thank you so much for telling us about the Voices project. And it sounds like some of the stories that you're uncovering could have their own Netflix series in the future. And if you'd like to find out more about Voices and the work that Jane and Declan are doing, you can find lots of information in the show notes. So that's it for our podcast this time round. Until next time, from myself, Claire O'Connell, Sloan, and thank you for listening.
The ADAPT Radio podcast is brought to you by the ADAPT Centre at Trinity College Dublin. Find out more about their extensive research work at adaptcentre.ie. Join us next time to hear about more groundbreaking innovations. To get new episodes automatically, just click the follow button on your player right now. The ADAPT Radio podcast is produced by dustpod.io, with episodes monthly on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.